It is early morning. The sun is just cracking the horizon and the beach is still washed in gray. In this early hour, a flock of long canoes skirts the coastline. The fishermen rowing the boats wave at the villagers gathered on the mangrove-choked beach. The land dwellers barely notice them. They are too busy hacking away at the cobweb-like roots of the trees, gathering up firewood for cooking. But the friendly wave is a signal. Warriors lying down on the bottom of the boats suddenly sit up. Oars cleave the water, throwing up a furious froth as the boats hit the shore. Before the villagers know it, the slavers, dressed in quilted vests the color of blood, are almost upon them. The cool dawn air rips a frightened keening from their throats as they begin to run. But the raiders leap from their boats and chase them down, knocking them to the wet sand with clubs. Perhaps a few villagers stand their ground. They are quickly surrounded and beaten to death. The slavers drag the children and young women through the mud as they would fetch higher prices in the market. Some mothers, blood streaming from their heads, beg the invaders to take them too, as they could not bear to be separated from their children. The separation happens anyway. Farther out at sea is a fleet of slave-raiding prahus, perhaps 40 or 50 ships strong. The captives are taken aboard different vessels. There's no time for farewells. There is only mounting terror as slavers strip them of their clothes and fasten a rattan ring on their necks. They also bind their limbs with rattan cords so tight that their hands lose their feeling. Up to 70 of them could be crammed inside the hold of a prahu. As the fleet continues on its deadly voyage, the newly caught slaves would be regularly beaten with a flat stick, the slavers hitting them hard on the knees and elbows and across the sides of their legs. They would also be fed with mere handfuls of rice and sago and water, just enough for them to survive to the next day. By the time they arrive at the market, their will to resist has been sanded down to a numb dread. Just weeks before, these villagers had woken up to gather firewood. Now, they are being dragged out to the stocks with hundreds or even thousands of other captives. Fishers, traders, sailors, passengers, and farmers from all over the archipelago, doomed now to live their new lives as slaves. Welcome to the Colonial Department. This is the podcast where we take long-lost stories from Philippine colonial history and bring them to life. In this episode, we take a look at how Spanish-controlled Philippines girded itself against the grave threat of slavers. This is Season 5, Episode 8, Defending Against the Slave Raids. Throughout the Spanish occupation, the threat of the Iranun and Balangingi slave raids was like an ominous storm cloud that hung over the islands of the Philippine archipelago. Perhaps the big cities like Manila or Cebu had nothing to fear, but the terror was a real and constant one for the smaller coastal towns on the empire's fringes. As historian James Francis Warren wrote,
"Few coastal towns and villages in southern Luzon were spared, while the Visayas and the northeast coast of Mindanao experienced some of the worst slave raids in the last quarter of the 18th century. The Visayan territories were especially prime targets in their dense populations and their developed coastal shipping."
Spanish records are packed with accounts of these ferocious attacks, which began to pick up in the 1750s. Over the next 100 years, towns in Leyte, Siargao, Tayabas, Catanduanes, Palawan, Mindoro, Sorsogon, Caraga, Butuan, Iligan, Albay, Zambales, Panay, and many more were hit. Entire communities were wiped off the map, entire populations were decimated, and entire towns were burned to the ground. Shipping lanes were also hit, with prahus plundering unprotected ships. Whether on land or sea, where the slavers went, corpses and captives followed. Those who survived or escaped capture often abandoned their homes, never to return. They built smaller, poorer homes on higher ground or tried their luck in the cities. Some gave up the seaside entirely and became refugees in the mountains, earning them the insulting Spanish nicknames of remontados, those who flee to the hills, or cimarrones, the runaways. But even the highlands were no guarantee of safety. At the height of their sea power in the late 1700s, raiders could land on the beaches of Negros, Panay, and Cebu and attack villages up to 20 miles inland. Many of the raids played out like the mangrove attack I narrated at the start of this episode. Lightning-fast raids, beachside abductions, helpless victims, outright thuggery. Small fishing villages offered little or no resistance to the marauders. But some bigger communities put up a fight. In 1754, invaders hit two well-defended towns, one in Palompon on the western side of Leyte and the other in Lubungan on the northern tip of the Zamboanga Peninsula. In both raids, the townspeople retreated into fortified positions. The slavers, who numbered in the thousands, went into siege mode. They surrounded the defenders with trenches and breastworks and began constructing siege towers. In the Leyte town, the attackers prepped 28 wheeled towers, while beside them, slavers set up ladders to swarm up the stockade walls. In the Zamboanga attack, these towers were roofed in the Roman manner, like a tortoise or testudo, with a heavy shell that housed gunners who could fire directly into the church where the townspeople were hiding. In addition, they were supported by cannon bombardment and rocket fire. In both attacks, the sieges failed. In Lubungan, the pirates were scared off when they spotted reinforcements marching in from another town. In Palompon, they gave up after 5 days of futile attacks. The invaders sailed away, and the villagers emerged from their fortifications, miraculously unscathed and unenslaved. Hi, this is Leo, creator of the Colonial Department. Sorry to interrupt your listening, but this is the part of the pod where I ask you to, well, like and subscribe. But seriously, taking 5 seconds to hit the follow button will really do a lot for this little independent podcast. Leave a rating too. I'd appreciate it. Alright, let's get back to some more Philippine history. Sprouting madly all over the coastline of the archipelago was the first line of anti-pirate defense, the Bantay, or as it was known in other parts of the archipelago, the Vigia. This was the village watchtower. In some seaside towns, the church belfry doubled as the Bantay, while in others, people had to build them from available materials. We can see how one of these looked like in a lithograph published in France in the mid-1800s. In the picture, which depicts the town of Zamboanga as it looked in the 1830s, a thatched hut standing on 6 stilts dominates the foreground, with a long ladder leading right up to its underbelly. It towers over the rest of the buildings as it stands guard on the edge of the seashore. Whether they were made of stone or bamboo, towers like these dotted the wiry coastline of the Philippines. When the southwest monsoon began to blow, signaling the start of slaving season, sentinels called telegrafistas kept a constant watch. If they spotted swarms of prahu approaching, the telegrafistas would give the signal, blowing a horn, beating on a drum, waving a flag, lighting up a torch, or frantically tolling the church bell. The townspeople would take refuge inside their baluarte, their fortress. Like the watchtowers, these took on many forms. Some were simple trenches built into hillsides, guarded by sharp stakes or thorny thickets. Others were stone houses with slits on the walls. More prosperous communities could retreat behind forts and palisade walls or barricade themselves inside the thick stone walls of their church. Perhaps the best anti-pirate deterrent was a face full of hot and deadly lead. Even the most reckless pirates would balk at assaulting a town protected by cannons and muskets. But understandably, few Spanish government officials wanted to be known as the guy who freely gave arms to natives. The paranoid administrators must have thought, who knows where these would end up? In one instance, their fears were confirmed. In the early 1800s, the government distributed 1,500 cannons to coastal villages. Many of them ended up in the black market, magicked away by unscrupulous mayors looking to make an easy buck. Funnily enough, their best customers would certainly have been the pirates themselves. So where was the Spanish colonial government in this long and terrible era of pirate attacks? From the point of view of the smaller, poorer, and more remote towns, it must have felt like the crown was nowhere to be found. Instead, it was the local friar who took charge of their defense. When slaving season began, he became not just their priest, but also their commander, technical advisor, artilleryman, first aid medic, shipbuilder, and arms procurer. In the words of one French observer,
"The friar is their leader by sea and land, and on account of his superior wisdom and courage, he is looked up to as a strong tower against the invasion and the inroads of the Mohammedans."
Some of these priests rally the townspeople like true generals. Take the case of Juan Bermejo, a Cebu friar who set up an early warning signal system, constructed a line of baluartes, and took the lead in creating a small coast guard, 10 boats strong, that would patrol southern Cebu. But it wasn't true that colonial officials were just sitting on their hands in the face of these relentless attacks. Since the earliest days of the occupation, the Spanish had organized expedition after expedition to Mindanao, in part to root the slavers out. They even used the pirates' own tactics against them. The Moros were using speedy prahus with shallow drafts to nimbly navigate around the islands. The Spanish did the same, ordering their Indio subjects to build agile caracoas. The Moros were taking slaves by the boatload. Well, the Spanish did too, and with the blessing of the law to boot. Under the Leyes Nueves, it was still perfectly legal to enslave Muslims, especially if you were waging a so-called just war. Still, the Spanish campaigns hardly inspired confidence. Spain only ever managed to secure a few footholds in Mindanao, and outside of their major centers of power like Manila or Cebu, their navy proved ineffectual in stopping the raids. In the late 1770s, their coast guard even became an outright laughingstock. When the Governor General set up a special Vinta tax to fund a fleet that would patrol the seas from Manila to Panay, the boats they ended up building were so poorly designed that they couldn't even set sail during bad weather. Within 2 decades, the expensive and useless program was scrapped. But as the 19th century progressed, the slave raids began to ever so slowly decline. Large-scale attacks became harder and harder to pull off as towns and cities became bigger and more populated. Decades before, pirates rolled in wheeled siege towers against major fortified towns. Now, they could only resort to sneaky dawn raids against helpless villagers at work. And then, of course, the Industrial Revolution arrived. In 1848, Spain sent 3 steam-powered ships down south to help invade the Balangingi Islands, a major base for the slave trade. These ships heralded the arrival of the steam age into the archipelago. Within 2 decades, the Cavite shipyards were assembling prefabricated steamships of war called canoneros. Whenever fleets of prahu encountered flotillas of canoneros in the open water, the wooden sailing ships were instantly annihilated. As one Spanish captain recounted of a sea battle,
"I gave the order to sink the pirates. A half an hour was all that was necessary to accomplish it, during which time the ram and cannon worked in unison to destroy them."
The feared pirate ships were now nothing more than splinters in the surf. Steam won out over sail, the age of the slave raids was coming to an end. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Colonial Department. Find us on Instagram and TikTok for more history, behind the scenes, and non-fiction book recommendations. If you want to learn more about the coming of steam power to the Philippines, listen to Season 3, Episode 11, The Dawning of the Age of Steam. Leo Mangubat wrote, narrated, and produced this episode. Anya Ong Reyes read quotations from sources. References include 1. James Francis Warren's landmark 1981 book, The Sulu Zone, 1768-1898. 2. Domingo Non's 1993 study on the effect of Moro slave raids on the Philippines, published in the journal Southeast Asian Studies.